It was strange that I should dwell on that period when I was in my teens, because Alex was in the Middle East, Eddie was in Burma, and I was in another tent with a lot of different young men. And it was as though the time between had been rubbed away, and Darabi and Helen and all my struggles in veterinary practice had never happened. Yet those years in Darabi had been the most important of my life. I used to sit up and shake myself, wondering at how much my thoughts had been mixed up by the war. But, as I say, I quite enjoyed Shropshire. The only snag was that reservoir, or whatever it was we were hacking out of the face of the hill. I could never get really involved with it. So that I picked up my ears when our flight sergeant made an announcement one morning.
"Some of our local farmers want help with their harvest," he called out at the early parade. "Are there any volunteers?"
My hand was the first up, and after a few moments' hesitation, others followed. But none of my particular friends volunteered for the job. When everything had been sorted out, I found I had been allotted to a farmer, Edwards, with three other airmen who were from a different flight and strangers to me. Mr. Edwards arrived the following day and packed the four of us into a typical big, old-fashioned farmer's car. I sat in the front with him while the other three filled the back. He asked our names, but nothing else, as though he felt that our station in civil life was none of his concern. He was about 35, with jet-black hair above a sunburnt face, in which his white teeth and clear blue eyes shone startlingly. He looked us over with a good-humoured grin as we rolled into his farmyard. "Well, here you are, lads," he said. "This is where we are going to put you through it." But I hardly heard him. I was looking around me at the scene which had been part of my life a few months ago. The cobbled yard. The rows of doors leading to cow byre, barn, pigsties and loose boxes. An old man was mucking out the byre, and as the rich bovine smell drifted across, one of my companions wrinkled his nose. But I inhaled it, like perfume. The farmer led us all into the fields where a reaper and binder was at work, leaving the sheaves of corn lying in long golden swathes. "Any of you ever done any stooking?" he asked. We shook our heads dumbly. "Never mind, you'll soon learn. You come with me, Jim." We spaced ourselves out in the big field, each of my colleagues with an old man, while Mr. Edwards took charge of me. It didn't take me long to realize that I'd got the tough section. The farmer grabbed a sheaf in each hand, tucked them under his arms, walked a few steps, and planted them on end, resting against each other. I did the same till there were 8 sheaves making up a stook. He showed us how to dig the stalks into the ground so that they stood upright, and sometimes he gave a nudge with his knee to keep them in the right alignment. I did my best, but often my sheaves would fall over and I had to dart back and replace them. And I noticed with some alarm that Mr. Edwards was going about twice as fast as the three old men. He had nearly finished the row while they were barely halfway along, and my aching arms and back told me I was in for a testing time. We went on like that for about 2 hours, bending, lifting, bending, lifting, and shuffling forward without an instant's respite. One of the strongest impressions I had gained when I first came into country practice was that farming was the hardest way of all of making a living. And now I was finding out for myself. I was about ready to throw myself down on the stubble when Mrs. Edwards came over the field with her young son and daughter. They carried baskets with the ingredients for our 10 o'clock break, crusty apple tarts, and jugs of cider. The farmer watched me quizzically as I sank gratefully down and began to drink like a parched traveller in the desert. The cider from his own press was superb, and I closed my eyes as I swallowed. The right thing, it seemed to me, would be to lie here in the sunshine for the rest of the day with about a gallon of this exquisite brew by my side, but Mr. Edwards had other ideas. I was still chewing at the solid crust when he grasped a fresh pair of sheaves.
"Right, lad, must get on," he grunted.
And I was back on the treadmill. With a pause at lunchtime for bread, cheese, and more cider, we went on at breakneck speed all day. I have always been grateful to the RAF for what they did for my physical well-being. When I was called up, there was no doubt I was going slightly to seed under Helen's beneficent regime. Too much good cooking and the discovery of the charms of an armchair. I was getting fat. But the RAF changed all that. And I don't think I have ever slipped back. After the 6 months at Scarborough, I am certain I didn't carry a surplus pound. Marching, drilling, PT, running, I could trot 5 miles along the beach and cliffs without trouble. When I arrived in Shropshire, I was really fit. But I wasn't as fit as Mr. Edwards. He was a compact bundle of power. Not very big, but with the wiry durability I remembered in the Yorkshire farmers. He seemed tireless, hardly breaking sweat as he moved along the rows, corded brown arms bulging from the sleeves of a faded collarless shirt, slightly bowed legs stumping effortlessly. The sensible thing would have been to tell him straight that I couldn't go at his pace, but some demon of pride impelled me to keep up with him. I'm quite sure he didn't mean to rub it in. Like any other farmer, he had a job to do and was anxious to get on with it. At the lunch break, he looked at me with some commiseration as I stood there, shirt sticking to my back, mouth hanging open, ribs heaving. "You're doing fine, Jim," he said, and then, as if noticing my distress for the first time, he shifted his feet awkwardly. "I know you city lads ain't used to this kind of work, and, well, it's not a question of strength, it's just knowing how to do it." When we drove back to camp that night, I could hear my companions groaning in the back of the car. They, too, had suffered, but not as badly as me. After a few days, I did begin to get the knack of the thing, and though it still tested me to the utmost, I was never on the border of collapse again. Mr. Edwards noticed the improvement and slapped me playfully on the shoulder. "What did I tell you? It's just knowing how to do it." But a new purgatory awaited me when we started to load the corn onto the stack. Forking the sheaves up onto the cart, roping them there, then throwing them again, higher and higher as the stack grew in size, I realized with a jolt that stooking had been easy. Mrs. Edwards joined in this part. She stood on the top of the stack with her husband expertly turning the sheaves towards him while he arranged them as they should be. I had the unskilled job way below, toiling as never before, back-breaking, the handle of the fork blistering my palms. I just couldn't go fast enough, and Mr. Edwards had to hop down to help me, grasping a fork and hurling the sheaves up with easy flicks of the wrist. He looked at me as before and spoke the encouraging words, "You're coming along, Grand Jim. It's just knowing how to do it."